Okay, let's go ahead and look at chapter 5 quickly. And this chapter, it's really an attempt to understand the nature of the motions of objects in our solar system. Again, from standing up above the North Pole of the Sun, looking down, trying to make sense of what's happening. I think there's a line in Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, that goes something like this. There's all the difference in the world between being on the inside looking out and on the outside looking in. And that's the way it is with the solar system. We're inside trying to figure out what's going on. To really understand it, you need more of a helicopter-level view, don't you, to be up above it looking down. And that's why it took so long for people to figure out, in fact, what was happening. And probably the first person to systematically investigate the motions of the planets was the Danish astronomer pre-telescope Tycho Brahe. He lives from 1546 to 1601. He's born just 3 years after Copernicus dies. He dies in 1601, 8 or 9 years before Galileo turns the first telescope toward the heavens. But he was convinced that the only way to really understand the heavens was to systematically observe them over long periods of time, keeping meticulous records and charts. He rejected the Copernican theory, and as we saw back in chapter 3, he came up with his own view of the solar system, what came to be known as the Tychonian system, and that's where everything, in fact, was orbiting about the sun, but the sun was orbiting about the earth. It's a modified geocentric view. The Catholic Church embraced it for centuries, the Tychonian view. It was not rejected until well into the 19th century. And Brahe is kind of notable for a number of reasons. Those 20 years of extremely detailed measurements of the motions of the known planets on the island of Hven off the coast of Denmark, where he spent all night, every clear night of the year, charting, chronicling the motion of the planets, amassing these detailed notes, which, by the way, he guarded very carefully and wouldn't let anybody look at them. In 1572, he detects the first supernova eruption in our galaxy in a half a millennium. And there's only been one since, and that was just 30 years later, about in 1604, when Kepler, Johannes Kepler, sees the last supernova explosion in the Milky Way galaxy 400 years ago. Astronomers predict there should be 3 or 4, perhaps, per century in a galaxy of our size. So we're many overdue. And all we can hope is that the next one is not going to be anywhere close, because if one of these things goes off within 100 to 300 light years, depending on a number of factors, it would absolutely destroy any life on the planet. Because what are you doing? You're talking about a star that erupts in a cataclysmic explosion so that over the course of several weeks, it radiates with the combined brightness of the entire galaxy, tens if not hundreds of billions of suns. What can account for that prodigious output of energy? The guy that got me interested in astronomy when I was in high school went on to get his PhD in theoretical astrophysics from the University of Illinois. He's done postgraduate work at a number of institutions. He's taught at MIT, the Fermi Lab, the Max Planck Institute in Germany. He's now at the Los Alamos Laboratories in New Mexico. And his doctoral dissertation was on supernovae explosion. And so I asked him once, you know, well, what is it? What causes it? He said, we don't know. So I thought, well, he's no better off than I am. So just like in law school, you know, before law school, I had a simple 3-word answer for every question. I don't know. After law school and all those tedious years and legal struggle, I still have a 3-word answer. It all depends. His famous pupil, Johannes Kepler, brilliant mathematician. Brahe never trusted him. They had a knockdown, drag-out fights. And, well, not physical, but certainly verbal. Maybe they were physical, too. But Brahe always distrusted him. And, in fact, it turns out that in 1601, Brahe dies mysteriously. And to this day, books have been written, just recently, another one, suggesting that Kepler murdered him. Why? Because within 2 days of Brahe's death, Kepler gets his hands on those charts that had been forbidden to him by Brahe for those years they worked together. He had a mask on his face. That's another interesting thing about Brahe, because in a duel, he had his nose chopped off, and so he spent the rest of his life, you know, trying to devise a kind of a natural-looking artificial nose. His body was exhumed in 1901, incidentally, and due to green coloration on the skull around the nasal cavity, physicians concluded that his nose was probably made out of copper rather than gold, as had been previously thought. Anyway, here's the island of Ven off the coast of Denmark, where he spent all those years, 20 years. Here's his journal in which he noted November 11, 1572, the eruption of this star. It is a truly an extraordinary event to be familiar with the heavens and to look in a particular constellation. And on one night, all of a sudden, there's a star there that hasn't been there before. And that's exactly what he was observing. He had no idea what it was, although he did correctly deduce that it was not a solar system object. He concluded it was farther away than the moon. And he was right. It's 7,500 light years away. And only in 1970 were astronomers able to detect the remnants of that particular supernova that goes by the name of Tycho's star. These are very ephemeral, very dim, because they're expanding so rapidly. And over 500 years, they're very attenuated. There's hardly anything there that we can see. And here's his pupil, brilliant mathematician, Johannes Kepler, gets his hands on those charts that Brahe had kept so meticulously. And he studies those for years, and he comes up with the formulation of the three laws of planetary motion. It was an amazing intellectual achievement. Let's take a look at those three laws. The first one, the first law of planetary motion. And it says this: every planet goes around the sun in an orbit that is an ellipse. This was anti-Aristotelian. You know, the Aristotelian concept, which dominated thought at this time in history, that everything had to be defined in terms of circles, that the orbits of the planets, if the solar system, in fact, was heliocentric, the planets were orbiting the sun in perfect circles. The idea that they're orbiting the sun in ellipses, basically ovals, that was heresy. What's an ellipse? Well, there are various ways to define it, but basically the distribution of points for which the sum of the distance from each point to two fixed points is equal. So for every point along the curve of the ellipse, from any point, the distance between these two fixed points, or foci, is the same. And you can illustrate that by just putting two tacks in a piece of paper and get a loop of string and put a pencil in that loop and make it taut, and then just start moving your hand, and it will draw an ellipse. And what's happening here? The combination of these two lines is the same everywhere around that curve. And, of course, ellipses vary in terms of their oblateness or their flatness, how close or far they are from a perfect circle. And we saw last time in the case of the Earth, our orbit is an ellipse, but it's very close to a perfect circle, our orbit around the sun. Now, it turns out that planets actually are not orbiting around the sun like Kepler thought. Actually, they're orbiting about a common center of gravity. Okay? That center of gravity is like somewhere in between them in many cases involving two orbiting bodies. Now, in the case of the sun, it's a little different, because the mass of the sun is so great compared to the mass of any planet. The mass of the sun is 1,046 times greater than the mass of Jupiter, which is 318 times greater than the mass of the Earth. I mean, you can see the numbers here. Jupiter is the biggest planet by far, and yet it is a fraction of 1% of the mass of the sun. But it's the most dominant planet. And because it is, when you look from above down at the solar system, it turns out that the sun is actually orbiting about the common center of gravity, which is outside of the surface of the sun. That's the only planet for which that is true. So if you would look down at the solar system, the sun would actually be moving slightly around a center of gravity that is slightly beyond its surface because of the gravitational attraction of Jupiter. Now, keep in mind, what does that mean? The sun is wobbling. And that is the very mechanism by which astronomers today have detected 276 exoplanets, which are planets outside of our solar system. That's one of the three major ways that this is done. And that's called the astrometric method, just detecting physically the wobble in another star. There's two other ways that exoplanets have been detected. And we've looked at the second one before, and that is Doppler shifts. If the planet's wobbling, at some point it's tilting toward us, our line of sight. Sometimes it's tilting away from us, right? Now, when it's tilting toward us, the radiation from that star is what? It's going to be blue shifted. It's moving slightly toward us. And when it's wobbling and its wobble is moving away from us, that wobble, the radiation is stretched. The wavelengths are stretched. It's red shifted. So believe me, these shifts are not much. Spectroscopists look at those spectral lines, and they can tell slight variations on a periodic basis. And that's the key. And that indicates the existence of another planet. And then the third way, and there are other ways, but these are the three major ways, is looking at light curves. And the idea is this, that in most cases, or many cases, from our orientation, the planet is going to go across the disk of that star. And when it does, it will slightly diminish the luminosity of the star. So again, looking for very slight changes in the luminosity of that star on a periodic basis over time. Now, what about Kepler's second law? And again, he figures this out looking at all these parchments that Brahe had kept. The straight line joining a planet and the sun sweeps out equal areas of space in equal intervals of time. So again, just put a dot somewhere on this elliptical orbit. And in the course of the same period of time, in this chart, we're talking about 1 month, that planet that's moving along in this elliptical orbit is going to sweep out an equal area of time. So if you look down here between points 1 and point 2, close to the sun, and that's called perihelion, it's got to be moving faster, doesn't it, to carve out a bigger area than when it's way out here at points 3 and 4 over that same 1 month period of time. And that's exactly right. What that means is when a planet, comet, asteroid is closest to the sun in its orbit, it's moving faster. It has to be. Otherwise, this second law is not going to be true. Whereas the farther out it gets, it has to be moving more slowly because it's sweeping out such a larger area of space. This is called aphelion, by the way, the farthest point from the sun in the orbit. Aphelion or aphelion, it goes by either, and perihelion, the closest point. I mean, it's kind of, when you think about it, to have figured this out by looking at those charts was quite an amazing achievement. Now, these are somewhat intuitive, but this third one is kind of bizarre, this third law. And that is this. This is called sometimes called the harmonic law. The square of a planet's orbital period in Earth years equals the cube of its orbital radius in astronomical units. Now, what in the world does that mean? By the way, an astronomical unit is the average distance of the Earth to the sun. We can round it up to 100 million. It's probably closer to 93 million miles, but we can round it for present purposes to 100 million. So the square of a planet's orbit around the sun in not its year, but in Earth years, you take the square of that, and that equals the cube of its orbital radius, that is its average distance from the sun, sometimes called its semi-major axis. The second law tells us that those orbital periods are longer for more distant planets because they're moving more slowly. But Kepler discovered a relationship between a planet's orbital period and the radius of its orbit, and that is this P, or this period in Earth years to orbit the sun squared, equals the average radius or distance of that planet from the sun cubed. And the importance is this. If we know the orbital period of a planet, we can compute its average distance from the sun. And that, in fact, is how the distance to the planets was measured for years, was with this third law. Here's an example of what we're talking about. And by the way, you can see on this chart, which is looking at all the planets here, including Pluto, what its period is, how long does it take to go around the sun, and what its average radius is, distance from the sun, in astronomical units. And Pluto's about 40. And it takes 250 years to go around the sun, approximately. Let's look at the Earth. You know, it's one and one. So if Pluto is 40 times farther, but it's got 247, 250 times longer year than the Earth. So what is this telling us? The farther out the object is, the slower it's moving. It's Kepler's second law. Now let's look at this for the planets. Here is the period of orbit going around the sun squared. That's this number right here. It's this column squared. Now that equals its average distance from the sun, what I'll call the radius of its orbit, cubed. And look at how close these numbers are. Look at Venus. It's exactly 0.378 in each case. What an extraordinary discovery. Look at Neptune. Exactly 27,160. And Pluto's slightly off. Well, there were a couple of problems with this. It was discovered, and Kepler knew this, that this didn't really work with the Earth and the Sun, nor apparently with any other planet and its satellites. So why would that be? The answer was provided several years later by Isaac Newton, 1643-1727. He is born in the same year that Galileo dies. He was born on a farm in Lincolnshire County, England. He was premature. His father passed away 3 months before his birth. He was a farmer. And the family expected Isaac to become a farmer. His mother remarries when he's three and ships him off to his grandmother, who raises him. And he never really forgave her for that because he didn't think much of his stepfather. But the stepfather eventually dies, and Isaac moves back in with his mother, begins farming, doesn't really like it, starts attending school. You know, he excels academically, and friends of the family encourage the mother to send him to college. And he was 18 or 19 when he started Cambridge University, Trinity College, which was quite old for that day. I mean, many people in their mid-teens started college. So he goes to Trinity College. You know, Cambridge University today consists of about 32 colleges, just one crammed in right next to the other. I don't remember how many there were then, 300 years ago, but Trinity College was one of them. So he goes to Trinity, and there he is exposed to many professors who are followers of René Descartes, Cartesian philosophers, whereas virtually every other college at Cambridge was imbued by Aristotelianism. So he ended up in the college where he was taught, you know, modern science from Francis Bacon and René Descartes and others. And he just soaks it up, and he just has a clear mastery of these concepts. And then in 1665 or 6, plague breaks out, and the university send all the students home for fear of the plague spreading. And so he goes back to the family farm in Lincolnshire. And he didn't have any books with him. But without so much as a single textbook, over the next 18 months on that farm, what one historian of science would later write, it was probably the greatest 18 months of intellectual production in the history of humanity. Because during that 18 months, when Newton was 20, 21 years of age, he discovers the three laws of motion. He discovers the law of universal gravitation. He discovers calculus. He discovers the law of optics, the binomial theorem. Those are just the major accomplishments, without so much as a book to help him. He returns to Cambridge after the plague subsides. He's in a class with the greatest mathematician in Europe, a guy by the name of Isaac Barrow. And a student asks Barrow a question, a very complex question. And he says, you know, that cannot be answered by mathematics. And Newton raises his hand, and he said, I think I can answer that. And Barrow said, well, please, show us how. So he comes down to the chalkboard, and he begins to explain the integral calculus and how that could answer this question. And Barrow, as brilliant as he was, dimly perceives that Newton had swerved into something that was truly revolutionary. And he was so stunned that he did something that day that had never happened before in the history of education and has never happened since. And that was, he takes a seat in the classroom and he says, "Mr. Newton, henceforth, you shall be the teacher and I shall be your student." And Newton becomes a professor of mathematics at Trinity College. And so he was for decades to follow. Always troubled to some extent by the fact that he was a Unitarian teaching at Trinity College. He spends the last 20 years of his life devoted almost exclusively to theological discourse. He wrote much more about theology than he did science. Here is his room. I had the privilege of teaching here just a few years ago, and this is one of the great yards. And this little red box here is Newton's room, where he actually stayed for 25 years. You know, people often ask, shouldn't you lock this off and make it a national treasure? And the answer from the university is always the same. We assume that every one of our students will be another Newton. So how can we, restrict this access to this room? So there's just a freshman or sophomore at Cambridge University, Trinity College, staying in that room. How would you like to stay in Isaac Newton's room? Unbelievable. Here's another vantage point of this yard at Trinity College. And there's a tradition of trying to run around the perimeter of the yard before the clock strikes 12. That race was depicted in Chariots of Fire. There's only two people that have actually accomplished that feat. One of them was middle distance runner Sebastian Coe when he was a student, who set 8 world records in middle distance races and is the only person to this day that has won back-to-back gold medals in the Olympic 1500-meter race. And he was the second person to have done it. These yards are some of the most beautiful lawns in all of the UK. It's interesting because for centuries, you had to be a priest to be a faculty member. And that meant you had to be celibate. And as a reward for your vow of celibacy, they passed a rule at every one of these colleges that only faculty could walk across the yards. I don't know if that's a fair trade or not. I don't think so. But now, even though they can marry today, the tradition stays. It's kind of like the genetic fallacy in logic. The Voyager 2, which is the farthest spacecraft from Earth of any human-made device, which is now 3 times the distance of Pluto in interstellar space, down close to absolute zero, still signaling to us with a little warble at 20 watts. And on the side of it is this gold record that Carl Sagan created, and we'll look at that in much more detail at the end of the semester. But one of the things contained on that is the first few pages of Newton's greatest book, The Principia. 25 years after this event at Cambridge, where he became a professor, and he was renowned as the greatest mathematician in all of England, there was a debate going on in England, in London, between Edmund Halley, Christopher Wren, and Robert Hooke, 3 of the greatest scientists of their day, as to the orbit of the moon about the Earth. Was it an ellipse or a circle? And if it was an ellipse, how could that be proven mathematically? And not knowing the law of universal gravitation, they couldn't answer that question. So Halley decides to go visit Newton at Cambridge. It's about 50 miles outside of London. And he goes up to his office, this cluttered office, and he asks Newton, "What is the orbit of a moon?" And Newton says, "Well, it's an ellipse." "Well, can you prove that?" "Absolutely. I proved that on the farm during the plague 25 years ago. And he said, "Well, do tell." And Newton begins shuffling through his desk looking for his scraps of notes that he had taken. And as one science historian would later say, at that moment, all of Europe was searching for the law of universal gravitation. Isaac Newton had lost it. And he finally finds it, and he shows it to Halley. And he's so impressed. He says, "You get to publish this and everything else you've invented." And through Halley's personal urging. Over 18 months, Newton puts it all together in the Principia, the greatest work in the history of science. And Halley writes the foreword, which concludes with these words, "Nearer the gods, no mortal may come." And a few years later, Newton passes away, and I'll show you his tombstone here in a minute. Alexander Pope writes the epitaph, which ends with these words, "All of creation was clothed in darkest night. God said, let there be Newton, and all was light." It's hard to to grasp the significance of this person. Newton is the first person that really shows us that we can understand how the natural world operates. It isn't a matter of superstition and fable, but there are laws that our Creator has made that will help us to understand how He has ordered the universe. And when we are studying the universe, we're doing nothing less than an act of piety and theology. Newton was clear on that. And of those people that shun the sciences as being somehow less noble than theology, Newton would absolutely denounce that point of view. Of all people, it ought to be Christians who are pursuing the study of the universe. Now, here is Newton on intelligent design. This is his conclusion in the Principia. "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." How about this? This is also from the Principia. "I have a fundamental belief in the Bible as the Word of God, written by those who were inspired. I study it daily." We'll return to that later. Here is a portion of a manuscript in Newton's own handwriting. I don't know if you can read that or not. But in this manuscript that was just recently rediscovered, I mean, we've known about this in the past, he predicts through his study of Scripture, which he devoted the last 20 years of his life to, that the world would come to an end in the year 2060. So I'll leave that with you for a year. Let me tell you, far less significant luminaries have made their predictions, haven't they? But you got to take with some seriousness the prediction of a guy like this. He never married. The guy was absent-minded. He often forgot to eat. He often was found wandering around Cambridge in a bathrobe, and people would take him by the hand and say, "Mr. Newton, no, your room is this way," and kind of escort him back. He was so deep in thought. You've seen people on campus like that, maybe. I don't know. Here's his tomb in Westminster Abbey. Now, here's why do I introduce Newton? Because we're going to see Newton several times through the rest of this course. But here we see him for the first time modifying Kepler's third law. He took that law of P squared equals R cubed. He looks at this, and after he had, you know, discovered this law of universal gravitation, he realizes that this Kepler's third law does not account for mass. And the only reason it works in the solar system is because the mass of the sun is so dominant compared to the mass of any planet that effectively you can ignore the planet. But that's not true in the Earth-Moon system or in double stars, where this Kepler's third law doesn't appear to work. So what does Newton do? He introduces mass into the equation. The radius cubed does not equal the period squared, but it equals the period times the combined mass of the two orbiting bodies squared. So the thing I want you to remember is he basically introduces mass into Kepler's third law. And you can rewrite that as follows: that the mass of both objects in an orbiting system equals the radius cubed, that's the distance, the average distance apart in astronomical units, divided by their period squared in Earth years. It doesn't make much sense when you're looking at a double star trillions of miles away, but that's the unit of measure for this equation. Let's take a look at how this works. Here's a double star system. As we'll see in a later chapter, this is really interesting. Do you know that when you look at the stars at night, they all look like individual stars, don't they? But in a telescope, and you'll see this when you come out to my house some night, probably 70% of the stars in the universe are double or multiple stars. They're not. We have what's called a bachelor star. It's one star and a solar system of planets. most stars are double stars or triple or quadruple stars, sometimes more, all orbiting about a common center of gravity. The most common example of this is a binary star like this. This is Albireo. It's the yellow and blue star. I took this picture just a few years ago. And if you monitor this in relation to, let's say, these three very dim, much more distant background stars, you'll see these stars remain fixed, and you'll start to see the little these stars start to rotate about a common center of gravity. You'll see motion over the course of 5 to 10 years. And with that, you can predict the orbit of those two stars. Okay, and that's true for any double star. Let's take a look at the nearest star to our sun, and that's the Alpha Centauri system, which is a triple star, basically a double with a very small dwarf star that's been discovered. Using Kepler's third law as modified by Newton, M1 and M2 are the two components of the double star, and it's been measured that their period of rotation is 80 years, 80 Earth years, and their average distance is 24 astronomical units. So using Kepler's third law as modified by Newton, we know that the combined mass of both of those stars in the Alpha Centauri system, the two primary stars, equals r cubed divided by p squared. And since we know those values, it turns out that the combined mass of those two stars is 2.1 solar masses. That's what this symbol means. What have we just done? We've measured the total mass of a binary star system located 25 trillion miles away using a 400-year-old equation. It turns out that that equation, I think, because we'll come back to this many times this semester, it could be said that it's the most powerful tool, analytical tool, in all of astronomy. It is how we measure the mass of the universe. It is how we measure the mass of stars. And with slight modifications, as we'll see in a future chapter, we can actually use it to measure the mass of galaxies. It's how we know that the matter in the galaxy is mostly dark. It's invisible to us. We know it's there because we can see the gravitational attraction. We can measure the amount of mass, but we can't detect it. 80% of the mass in the universe is invisible to us. We know it's there by this law. So it is a powerful analytical tool that we will see over and over again. Two last things in this chapter to cover: the inverse square law. We see the inverse square law in the context of gravity and also electromagnetic radiation or light. Okay, in the context of gravity, the force of gravity, Newton said this, between two objects decreases based on the square of the distance between them. It's the inverse square law. Mathematically, you can put it this way: gravity, the force of gravity, decreases by the reciprocal of the distance squared. Let me give you a couple of examples of what this means. If the separation between two bodies increases 3 times, the gravitational attraction is only 1/9, the reciprocal of the distance squared. If the separation increases 4 times between two bodies, the gravitational attraction is only 1/16 of what it would otherwise be if they were tangent. Gravity diminishes according to the reciprocal of the distance squared. The same is true for radiation. Light diminishes. And that's why just getting out of town 10 miles has a dramatic effect on the clarity of the sky and the amount of light pollution saturation, because the inverse square law is working to your advantage every mile you go. And the last thing in this chapter is angular momentum. What is that? It's a measure of the momentum of any orbiting object. And the basic idea is this: angular momentum is equal to mass times velocity times distance from the center. Absent any outside forces, an orbiting object's angular momentum is conserved, meaning it doesn't change. And since the mass of an object usually remains the same, if distance between two objects decreases, the velocity must increase to maintain that conservation of angular momentum. Conversely, if the distance increases, the velocity of orbit, the orbital velocity must decrease since the mass is constant for the product of those three terms to be the same or conserved. It's a powerful tool in astronomy. It more or less explains Kepler's third law. Closer planets move faster. We see this with skaters. As they're spinning, when they put their arms in, what are they doing? Their mass has not changed, but the distance has. And since the distance has decreased, the velocity must increase. And similarly, when they put their arms out, distance is increasing, mass is constant, speed must decrease. Angular momentum. It applies to skaters, it applies to stars and galaxies.